Yaakov and Shiva, welcome to the Israel Leads program. We're glad to be linked in the link to Israel. After all, Israel Leads, about on campus, at a Yashivistan, this is all really part of what we are interested in doing, which is people coming to Israel and linking and connecting and learning, studying Torah. As maybe you've day you've been aware before, there are students gathered here together studying, learning Torah from all walks of life, from all kinds of backgrounds, or without, or with very little background in Judaism and in Torah studies. There's no prerequisite to become a student of this yeshiva other than the commitment to being a serious student. Even if someone is not that much of a student, I don't know about serious, but student because anyway. And the bottom line is, I want the students who are here to then, you know, hold the capacity. So it's very, very exciting, and it gives us, you know, now we're in the period of the time period, I'm sure you're aware of the 9 days where we're mourning for the temple, and that's why I guess also it's part of the plan that you're actually here now in Jerusalem. I don't know for when the group is here, but you're here in what? So Sunday. You're getting the feeling of when we talk about Jerusalem and we hear about Jerusalem and we mention Jerusalem in our prayers. It's a real place, and it, as beautiful as it is, it can and it will be. Its beauty that it's going to get is going to be incredible. But this is the place that people are looking forward to, and now we are mourning the fact that it's not in its real sense the way it's meant to be. It's not in its full glory. And at this time, which is a little sad for us, your coming and seeing guests brings us that it helps us. It comforts us. It tells us that there's great things in store for us, because God willing, we're looking forward to see each and every one of you here again. Even if you don't go back and you decide to stay, we can talk about it. And you'll join us here. I hope you had a good time here today, and it'll only get better from there. So we're very happy to have you with us, and we're looking forward to much more. And you get a chance, I don't know if you did, you'll ask the guys if it's really that way. The guys that are here already, I hope, you know, they'll only tell you nice things about us. But I think it can really work. To that end, this is also a great book for us. We're going to hear now from Rabbi Yossi Jacobson. A man of many titles, wears many hats. Very famous community rabbi in Crown Heights, Rabbi Zeit Shmuel, Mashpia, editor, world acclaimed lecturer, but to us and my enough, one of the nicest things we can say about Rabbi Jacobson is that he's spent many good summers, many good times with us, and back in the day when my enough wasn't yet in this building and was in its beginning stages, he really put in a lot of effort to help us and to help us grow and develop, and Baruch Hashem, thank God, to inspire and teach many students who've walked through our first summer program. It's very, very special. Every time Rabbi Jacobson comes back, we feel like he's come back home. So it's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Jacobson, and we're looking forward to hear. And all the other people that have come along, the people that have come to listen, you're all very welcome. I hope you can all find seats. I believe there should be more chairs, and we could work it out. Please make yourself at home. And as said, our hope and our prayer is that all of you shouldn't have to go back to America or to wherever it may be, but you'll stay here in Yerushalayim, in Israel, with us, with the coming of Mashiach. May it happen now. I will point out, at 1:30, Mirtz Hashem is practically as Mincha, and following Mincha will also be a Siyam, a conclusion of a tractate, so please stay tuned.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Rabbi Zichman, for your kind words. I want to welcome as well Israel Links to the Mayanot Institute of Jewish Studies. Therefore, I'm welcoming myself as well, being part of Israel Links of summer 2010. They tell a story about a Jew who used to go into the bar every night and order two drinks, two glasses of Crown Royal. He went down every single night. The bartender asked him why. So he said, one I drink for myself, and the other I drink for my best friend. I was together with him in Vietnam. He died. We used to have a drink every night. And in order to remember him till the end of my life, I drink every night two glasses of Crown Royal, one for him, one for me. And so night after night, the bartender says, you don't want to change your menu? He says, nope, my friendship is the most precious thing to me, and therefore, I drink every night two cups for him, and for me, the same two glasses of Crown Royal every night. 30 years go by. One night, he comes into the bar, and lo and behold, he orders one cup of Crown Royal. The bartender is astounded. He says, what happened? So he says, I'll tell you, I quit drinking. So this is not only a classical case of Jewish denial. Denial is not only a river in Egypt, it's also part of people's lives, but it also represents a form of camaraderie and friendship where I can actually experience another person. I'll just listen to another person to the point where I'm not even drinking, I'm just drinking my friend's cup. Every time I come back to my Anat, so I feel immediately in the year that sense of not just a commitment to study, but also a sense of camaraderie and brotherly love and energy, which is one of the most powerful concepts of a yeshiva, not just a place where people study academically and independently, but also a place where a community of learning is created, bonds created that last a lifetime, bound by eternal values and by eternal commitments and by profound friendships. You know, there is a famous statement in the Talmud. The statement in the Talmud says this very strange statement. Somebody who builds a home among the Jewish people, it's like he reconstructed one of the churvas of Jerusalem. Churvas is one of the many destroyed places in Jerusalem. When you travel to Jerusalem, you see there's some places where there's ruined rocks here and there. A bunch of churvas. Now they rebuilt a lot of things already. But churvas are destroyed old buildings and edifices. So the Talmud says when somebody builds a home in Israel, when somebody builds a home in the Jewish people, among the Jewish people, it's like they rebuilt a destroyed home in Jerusalem. So everybody asks the question, why is it like they rebuilt a home in Jerusalem? Why not rebuild a home in Tel Aviv? Or rebuild a home in any other part, in Dallas, or in Chicago, or New York? Why is getting married, building a home, compared to rebuilding, renovating a structure in Jerusalem? What if you're not getting married in Jerusalem? What if you're getting married in Toronto? One of the answers that's given is that there's a difference between building in Jerusalem and building in any other part of the world. Usually, and I'm sure some of you will end up in real estate since some of you are Jewish. I meant it seriously, by the way. It wasn't a joke. You build anywhere in the world, right? So you buy a property, either you renovate it, or you flatten it, or you buy an empty lot, and you put up a building, you put up a home, you put up a mansion, you put up an office, whatever you put up there. And the real estate market works around the world. Jerusalem is very different. Jerusalem, you buy a plot, or you buy a building, there's no such a thing as an empty plot, and you put up a building. There's no such a thing, you clean everything out, and you start anew. The moment you start digging in Jerusalem, you find
that 10 feet or 5 feet under the ground, there was already a whole generation living there. And then when you dig another 5 feet, there was another generation living there. And then another 10 feet, there was another generation living there. So you have layers upon layers upon layers, which is why the archaeological excavations here continue for decades. When a person builds a new home, in many ways they're starting anew. They're starting fresh. They're beginning a new life, a new future, a new destiny, which is what young people are supposed to do. So the Talmud says, when you build a home among the Jewish people, it's like building a destroyed home in Jerusalem. Meaning, you're not just building a new edifice. You're building a home on top of layers and layers and layers of structures that already existed earlier. So in other words, you're not just starting afresh, but you're also continuing a chain that went for thousands of years. And although you may be adding great height and great splendor to your structure, but your structure is not a new experience, it's a continuation of thousands of years of dedication, of blood, of sweat, of tears, of passion, of study, and of sanctity, of truth, and idealism that you build upon. And that's really the power of these programs, like I Am Not, like Israel Links, because as I can see here, there are people from different backgrounds. Some of you I know, even from I Am Not, some I don't. But there's a common denominator, namely many of you, many of us, have come from backgrounds in which there was very little or scant Jewish education. Growing up in lovely homes, more lovely, less lovely, nice communities, better childhoods, worse childhoods, more challenges, less challenges. But many have had a little opportunity to explore Judaism in a serious, profound, intellectual, academic environment. Really, what does Judaism have to say during the last four millennia? And sometimes, when you come from such a background, the gap is so profound that it's easy to give up. You open up the first book of Talmud and you see the grandeur, the gap of understanding, the barriers of language, of literature, of information. There's so much. And when there's so much and I'm so far, should I even begin? Do I really belong here? Am I really connected? If I was born into it, so from day one, I was already saturated with the language, with the literature, with the wisdom. Okay, but since I come from a very different place, am I even connected to this? Maybe I should just give up and just follow the route that I was on a few years ago. Why shake the boat? And why leave my comfort zone? For this you have to remember that it's not the case, because what you experienced in your life was only an interruption of at most one or two or three generations. But right before those three generations, you come from thousands of years of Jews who lived and breathed in Jerusalem, or in the Jerusalems around the world that they created, the virtual Jerusalems, who were completely saturated with Torah. So it may have been interrupted for three generations, maybe four generations, maybe two generations, parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, maybe great-grandparents. But right before that, every single one of us is a link in a chain that didn't begin 50 years ago or 100 years ago. They once asked a Chinese politician what was his opinion of the American Revolution and the French Revolution. And the Chinese politician said, it's too early to tell. 250 years versus 4,000 years is not a long time. But coming from 4,000 years of a continuous structure and commitment. So when we look at ourselves, we can't only look at ourselves within the context of the last 20 years, or even the last 50 years, or even the last 200 years, or 150 years. You look at yourself in the context of 3,300 years. Now what's 200 years within the context of 3,300 years? A very little, a very minuscule part of it. So the majority of your life, the majority of your history, you were soaking and bathing in the light and the radiance of Judaism and its teachings. There is a story that I want to share with you today. It's a very difficult story to understand, and I need you students to help me understand the story. What did you do before this? You had chavrusas? What did you guys do before this? Huh? You were learning with Talmud? Which book? Huh?
Bava Kama.
Okay. The Talmud, as you know, has 60 tractates, right? 60 tractates. What's the Talmud? Everyone knows the word Talmud, but it's good to define it, even for the prominent students of Maya not. It won't hurt to define what the Talmud is. The Talmud is considered the most classic compilation of Jewish wisdom and literature. It's the basic compilation of 60 tractates, each tractate dealing with a different subject, and it includes within itself the laws of Judaism, its legal structures, literature, history, homiletics, spiritual ideas, moral ideas, ethical ideas, the structure of Judaism on every level. It was compiled in Babylonia, present-day Iraq, during the first centuries after the Common Era, following the destruction of the Second Temple in Babylonia, present-day Iraq, over a few hundred years, and it's called the Babylonian Talmud, and it has 60 tractates. Some people spend a lifetime studying it because it's very complex. First of all, the language is Aramaic, which was the prevalent language, spoken language of Jews in Babylonia. They spoke not Hebrew, but Aramaic. Like the Kaddish is not in Hebrew, but in Aramaic. It's Gadal, it's Kadash, Shmei, Rabbah are Aramaic words. Hey, Lach, Ma'ani, in the beginning of the Seder, before Manishtan, is in Aramaic. Other prayers in Aramaic, because they were composed by Jews in a time when most of them spoke not Hebrew, but Aramaic, which was the language of the time, and the Talmud was also written in Aramaic. Besides the language, its messages, its ideas are very complex and multi-layered, and hence some people spend a lifetime on it. The first tractate of the Talmud is called Brachot. It deals with the laws of blessing that we make according to Jewish tradition before we eat and after we eat. There's a tractate called Shabbat, which deals with the Shabbos. A tractate called Psachim, which deals with Passover holiday. A tractate called Megillah, which deals with the laws of Purim when we read the Megillah. A tractate called Gittin, which deals with the laws of divorce. Kiddushin, the laws of marriage, etc., etc. Brachot is the first one, and it deals with blessings. Bracha means a blessing in Hebrew. Brachot is plural blessings. In tractate Brachot, there's a story. Following story. Page 28b, for those who don't believe me, or if you want to look it up afterwards. The Talmud says this. There was a great Jewish sage whose name was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Yochanan, the son of Zakkai. Ben means the son. Most sages are identified with their father's name. Yochanan is the name. Ben Zakkai, the son of Zakkai. We Israelites, a few days ago, were at his resting place in Tiberias, right near the tomb of Maimonides, Rabbi Moses Maimonides, the Rambam. Right nearby is the gravesite of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. So, and the man named the known as the Shalah, Rabbi Yeshaya Horowitz. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was sick, and he was about to pass on. The Talmud says his students went in to visit him. And as they went in to visit him, they saw that he was weeping. And they asked him, "Why are you weeping, master?" And he said, "I'm weeping because when one dies and one comes to heaven, there are two ways, there are two pathways. One pathway takes you to paradise. And one pathway takes you to Gehenna, which is purgatory. Ve'eini yodeya be'ezederech ve'lichinais, and I don't know which path they're going to take me down. Are they going to take me to the path to paradise, path to purgatory?" Which reminds me of an anecdote. There was a Jew. We're going to call him Robert Schwartz. If there's a Schwartz here, probably your fourth or fifth cousin, I'm not sure. Robert Schwartz was not very fond of Judaism. Schwartz was one of those Jews, you know, who hated Judaism with religious fervor. So he was very religious in his hate to Judaism, which is true about many Jews. They're very religious. They're sometimes more religious than religious Jews, but the religion is expressed in different ways. Like a lot of Jewish atheists, for example, are atheists with religious passion.
He was one of those. Every morning he would wake up, open the Bible, and whatever the Bible said to do, he would not do. Whatever the Bible said not to do, he would do. This was the way he engaged Judaism on a daily level. This is also a common Jewish occurrence. It's their way of connecting. And so he lived a life of absolute sin, and the day he died comes up, and you know when you come up to heaven, they print out a data on the computer. They have a data of everything you ever did. So it prints out, and then they read through the list, and they decide your destiny based on it. So they print out the data. Wow, extraordinary amount of sins. So the devil comes and says, Mr. Schwartz, straight to purgatory, straight to the grand barbecue where you're going to fry. On the way to the grand barbecue, the white angel comes out and says, wait, wait, wait. I was reading through the biography, and I see that on January 2nd, 2005, Mr. Schwartz was walking on 42nd Street and Bowery in Manhattan. Cold night. It was a homeless man who turned to him and said, you know, I need one nickel in order to be able to have enough money to buy orange juice. I haven't had a drink in 2 days. Please, sir, just give me a nickel. And even Mr. Schwartz could not refuse this poor homeless man, took out a nickel, gave it to him. The white angel says that's a mitzvah. It's called charity. It's called tzedakah. You have to reward him for what he did. You can't just ignore that mitzvah. I don't care if he sinned all of his life. A mitzvah is a mitzvah. I want a reward for Mr. Schwartz for doing charity that late night, January 2005 in Manhattan for the homeless man. Got a point. They convened the heavenly Supreme Court to consult. What do you do with this Mr. Schwartz? It was a 4-hour heated debate among the Supreme Court. They say that even God attended the meeting, although usually he's busy with Middle Eastern politics, but that meeting he had to come to. And they're debating back and forth, what do we do with this guy? Does it make sense that a person who sinned his whole life, lived it up, violated every law in the book, and followed every instinct without inhibition and restraint, should get paradise just because he gave a little lousy charity to some homeless guy when it was freezing? Come on! A little proportion, a little sense. After 4 hours, the Chief Justice in heaven took a hammer, order in the courts, gave a knock on the knock, gave a bang on the bima, and said, we have a verdict. And the verdict is, give him back his nickel and let him go to hell. The problem, of course, is they start looking for a nickel. There's no nickels in heaven. In heaven, you could maybe find some tzitzis, maybe a Torah, maybe a prayer book, maybe a Talmud. No nickels in heaven. No sushi in heaven. No nickels in heaven. And according to the Muslims, you got other things in heaven. But the Jews don't really have these stuff in heaven. But in order to send them there, they got to have a nickel. They can't find a nickel. So my friend, it's been 5 years that they're still looking for a nickel. And Mr. Schwartz is still enjoying the rewards of his mitzvah until they can find a nickel and let him go to hell. Now, I heard a story from somebody who came back and shared it with me. Rabbi Schwartz, he shared it with me from California. Either he was there or he heard it from somebody who was there. But this comes from reliable sources, like most things that you can read in the media about come from equally reliable sources. But there's a moral to the story. The moral to the story is, one of the greatest things that paralyze people is the fear of hypocrisy. They tell themselves, if I'm not going all the way, I'm not even going to begin. And since I know I'm not ready to go all the way, therefore I'm not even going to begin. Either I do the full package, or I let go of the package. But the truth is, although it's a common instinct, it's not the Jewish approach. Jewish approach is that every positive thing a person does in his or her life has extraordinary meaning and significance. There's no such a thing, all or nothing. Mr. Schwartz did one mitzvah, and that itself is very powerful. And the same is true in our own life and in our own growth, in Judaism or any other area. The all or nothing is an enemy. Aristotle, I think, or somebody once said that perfection is the enemy of all progress. If you're a perfectionist and you wait for perfection, where are you going to get? Back to the Talmudic story, Tractate Brachos. Rabbi Yochanan, the son of Zakkai, is about to pass on. He's crying. He says there are two paths, and I don't know which path they're going to take me to. Either the path of paradise or the path of purgatory. How can I not weep? Right before he died, he turns to his students and says, make a place for Chizkiah, the king of Judea. Actually, a few days ago, we went through the tunnel that Chizkiah built to get out of Jerusalem. You remember the tunnel? 40-minute walk in water. It was very exciting and claustrophobic. Some people even decided to sing throughout the tunnel. I guess they like hearing themselves, but I'm not going to analyze them now. And this was the tunnel that Chizkiah built. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who lived after the Second Temple era, says, make room for Chizkiah, who lived hundreds of years before, during the First Temple era. Make room for him, and he passes away. And that's the end of the story. Now, I want to ask you a question. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was considered the leader of the Jewish people of that generation. When did he live? We know exactly when he lived. He lived during the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70 after the Common Era, which means exactly 1,940 years ago to date. 70 to 2010, I believe, is 1940, right? Huh?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. It's exactly 1,940 years that the Romans burnt the temple, and he was alive then. He was the leader of the Jewish people. He was considered the greatest Torah scholar of the time. He was the leader of the Jewish Sanhedrin, which is the Jewish Supreme Court. It was the central body of the Jewish people. Today we don't have that anymore. Today every community is on its own, more or less. And even within a community, you can have many communities, as you know. But then there was one central body called the Sanhedrin. It was like the spiritual central organization that was responsible for the Jewish people, called the Sanhedrin. He was the leader of it. He was a teacher of countless students. He was the greatest teacher of Judaism, and he was a tremendous leader. Before his death, he tells his students, I don't know if I'm going to heaven or I'm going to hell. Really? Well, if you don't know where you're going, what should we say about ourselves? So you might say humility. But humility doesn't mean, like some people think, false self-perception. If I'm tall and I say I'm short, I'm not being humble, I'm being stupid. Right? If somebody is fat and says, I'm skinny, they're not being humble, they're just lying. Humility doesn't mean that when you have an obvious characteristic and you deny it, you're very humble. You're not humble, you're just saying a lie, or you're fooling yourself. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did not know who he was. He did not know that he spent his life learning and studying and leading and teaching and inspiring. He did not know that he was considered the spiritual leader of the Jewish people. These were undisputed facts. Did he really believe on his deathbed that he's going to hell? He's going to purgatory? He's crying and he says, I don't know which way I'm going. I don't know if I'm going to paradise. I don't know if I'm going to purgatory. Did that really enter his mind honestly right before his death? That that's where he's going to end up? Did he really think he was such an evil person? It's ridiculous. It's ludicrous. What exactly was going through his mind? There are many answers given to this, because it's a difficult question. I'm going to share with you one answer. And as always, one story is enlightened by another story. The Talmud discusses different life stories of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. One stands out. And this is not in Tractate Brachos, but it's in Talmud Tractate Gittin. A different tractate. Far later than Brachos. Brachos is the first. Gittin is much later. And this is actually a story that deals with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai in a different era. And I want to share with you the story. And the story goes like this. The Romans besieged the city, Jerusalem, for a long time, for many years. The Jews revolted against the Romans. Roman occupation, Roman authority, Roman dictatorship. And the Romans finally decided, enough, we're going to lay waste to this people, destroy their country, burn their temple, and put an end to their national sovereignty and independence and commonwealth. Who is the spiritual leader of the Jewish people who lived in Jerusalem? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Now the Jews then split up into groups. One group believed you got to fight the Romans till the end. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was of a different opinion. He believed that Rome was extremely powerful and they had to negotiate some type of compromise. The zealots, as they were called, would not want to hear of any compromise, of any negotiations. Rabbi Yochanan felt they're making a mistake because Rome would have the power to destroy them. And therefore, unfortunately, under the circumstances, you have to negotiate with Rome. The Jews had enough food to sustain them in Jerusalem, but these zealots burnt the storages of food so that the Jews would be forced to go fight the Romans because they would need to get food from outside of Jerusalem, which was besieged by the Romans. So they really created chaos within the city. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was fearing everything will be lost. These zealots would not let any Jew go out of Jerusalem. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was destined, determined to go to the Romans outside of Jerusalem. So what did he do? He had himself officially die. Now, you don't bury a dead person within the walls of Jerusalem. It has to be outside of the walls of Jerusalem. The students put him in a coffin, and this was the only reason they would let people go out of Jerusalem, to bury. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was carried outside of Jerusalem as a corpse, but he wasn't really a corpse. He was a fake corpse. He was really alive. He just had to get out of the city to negotiate with the Romans. He managed to get through the security, which was also complicated. When he came out of the coffin, and he went to meet the Roman general at the time, who was Vespasian. His name was Vespasian in Hebrew, or in Talmudic language, Aspasianus. Aspasianus, whom we call Vespasian. Vespasian then was the Roman general, the Roman commander of the troops around Jerusalem. Rabbi Yochanan spoke to him, schmoozed with him, and the Talmud says that when Rabbi Yochanan met him, he said, "Peace unto you, king. Peace unto you, the king." So he told Rabbi Yochanan, "You deserve to die. First of all, treason. You called me the king. He was not the Caesar. Who was the Caesar at the time? A man named Nero. N-E-R-O. He was just a commander. So it's treason. And number two, if I'm the king, why didn't you come to me till today?" So Rabbi Yochanan said, "You say I'm not the king. Now you're not the king, but you're going to be the king. And you say, why didn't I come to you till now? Because I could not get out to you. I could not come to you. In the meantime, news comes that the Caesar died and the Senate appointed Vespasian as the new Caesar." Vespasian was deeply impressed with Rabbi Yochanan, and he tells him, "Rabbi, I'm in control now. Name your wish and I will give it to you. Whatever you want, ask me for something and I will grant your wish." He was so impressed by him. "I grant you a wish. What do you say?" Rabbi Yochanan asked for three things. One thing he asked for was, the Talmud says, "Don't exterminate the family of Rabban Gamliel." There was one family that came from King David, the Davidic dynasty, the family of Rabban Gamliel. "Don't exterminate that chain so that there should be at least one Jewish survivor from the King of David." Why did he want that? Because Mashiach is going to come from King David. Number two, he said, there was a man named Rabbi Tzadok, a great sage who fasted for 40 years in repentance that the temple shouldn't be destroyed, and he was like a skeleton at the time. "Provide me a good physician for Rabbi Tzadok." And then he had one more request. His other request was 10 liyavna v'chachameha. 10-20 miles from Jerusalem is a city called Yavne. Yavne was the academic center of the Jewish people. That's where the yeshivot were. That's where my anut would have been. That's where the Sanhedrin was, the Jewish Supreme Court. That's where the students were learning. That's where the rabbis were teaching. was the center of Jewish study called Yavne. He tells Vespasian, you're going to destroy the country. Spare me Yavne. Let Yavne be intact with its sages. Don't destroy that. Vespasian agreed. He was now the Caesar. He went back to Rome. He sent his son Titus to replace him. Within a short while, they breached the walls. The ninth above, they burned the temple. According to Josephus, close to 1 million Jews were massacred. The rest were sold as slaves and taken to Rome and other countries. There were so many Jewish slaves at the time that they said that the price of a slave was less than a dollar. Imagine a slave for life for less than a dollar because there were too many slaves. Jerusalem was plundered, the temple destroyed, Jewish people decimated, its national sovereignty deleted, and Jews exiled. But there was a back to Reb Tzadok, and Gamliel's family wasn't exterminated, and Yavne was speared. And the long exile under Rome began. That year, 1940, years ago, the 9th of Av, 70 after the Common Era, mourned every year in the Jewish calendar next Tuesday, July 20th, Jews fast. They don't drink and eat on the 9th of Av, like Yom Kippur. We don't bathe, we don't engage in intimacy, and so on and so forth, just like Yom Kippur as a national day of mourning around the world, the saddest day in the Jewish calendar, Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av. 100,000 Jews in chains go to the Kotel, to the remnant of the temple where they sit on the ground and pray, read lamentations, and so forth. This is the story in Tractate Gittin. Now, it's possible to suggest that when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was on his deathbed, let's go back to the first story, his life was going by him. And he said, I don't know if I'm going to end up in paradise, and I don't know if I'm going to end up in purgatory. Why? It was this story that gave him no rest. You know, sometimes you live a life, a good life, a virtuous life. But when you look back, there's one thing that bothers you. There's one thing that's torturing you. There's one thing that eats up on your conscience. We each have it in our own life. You know, you say, are you a guy, a good guy? Yeah, you're a good guy, I'm a good guy. But sometimes there's one thing that it's very hard to forgive yourself for. And if you live with that, it's not fun. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai lived a great life, a virtuous life, a meaningful life, a productive life. When he was on his deathbed, his life flashed through his brain. And then you remember this scene. And he asked himself one question. Did I not, in my position, betray the Jewish people for eternity? Let me ask you to visualize yourself in such a position. Not many people are given this opportunity. But once in a while, there's one individual who's given the opportunity to determine the fate of history, of an entire people, of an entire nation. And he, at that moment, he was standing in front of the most powerful person of the time, Vespasian. Vespasian said, you ask for something, and I'll give it to you. He knew that Rome dominated the world. All the roads were leading to Rome. When you're in Rome, you do as in Rome. He knew the power of Rome, and Rome's power would continue for hundreds of years until its decline a few centuries later. It would become Christian in the meantime by Constantine. And you're standing in front of the Roman Caesar, and he gives you an opportunity, and he says, ask for one thing and I'll give it to you. And you're leading a people that you know, stood at Mount Sinai and heard the voice of God, got the Torah, built two temples, has been around for a while now. For 1500 years they've been around. But now is a moment of truth. And it's all going to go up in flames. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is told by the Caesar, ask for something and I'll give it to you. What do you ask? Rabbi Yochanan couldn't tell Vespasian, wait, let me go call the rabbi and let me find out what the rabbi says. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai couldn't say, wait, I'm going to make a summit of all the greatest Jewish thinkers and we're going to convene and meet for 8 days and 8 nights
and sit in air-conditioned lobbies and beautiful salons and hotels in the King David and eat sushi and drink wine and decide the future of Jewish continuity, as in so many beautiful conferences the Jews have. And at the end they decide we're going to have another conference next summer. You couldn't do that. This was also not a question he could say, one second, let me go to the bookcase, let me take out the code of the Jewish law, and let me see what you tell the space here. These are questions you're not going to find in the code of Jewish law. You're not going to find in the Talmud, in the Bible, in the Medrash. What do you tell the space here? If a drop of milk falls into cholent, then you can go to the code of the Jewish law, open it up to the laws of Taruvah, to the laws of Kashrut, and figure out if the cholent is qualified for Jewish consumption, or heaven forbid, God preserve you, the cholent must be cast into the dustbin. These are questions that rabbinic students sit for years, and they learn all the intricacies in the code of Jewish law. What happens if milk falls into meat? When is it nullified? When is it not nullified? But you can't always, if you don't always have the luxury to look up your questions in a book. You're standing in front of a space here, and he says, name your wish. Which book do you go to? These are questions you can't answer from books. You can't answer from rabbis. There's nobody to call. There's nobody to turn to. You're standing with your guts and your kishtas, yourself in front of him, and you have to come up with an answer. And Rabbi Yochanan asked for three things. And at the end of his life, he asked himself, did I not betray my people? Should have I not asked him to spear Yerushalayim? Should have I not asked him to spear the Beit HaMikdash, the Holy Temple with the Divine Presence rest? Should have I not asked him to retreat and let us remain in our capital with our temple? He did not. He felt, apparently, Vespasian would laugh. It would be too much. So he asked for smaller things, perhaps. In fact, the Talmud says there were some sages, like Rabbi Akiva, no less, who were upset at Rabbi Yochanan. They said that at sometimes the smartest people think backwards about his decision. Years later, on his deathbed, decades later, he looks back at his life. He's at peace with himself. And there's no serenity like the serenity of being at peace with your conscience, at peace with yourself. But that would not give him peace. What if I would have asked Vespasian, leave my people alone, leave Jerusalem intact? Am I not single-handedly, indirectly responsible for the destruction of our commonwealth, for the destruction of our national sovereignty, for the destruction of our spiritual epicenter, for the destruction of our capital, and for the dispersion of our people? Because I didn't have the guts and the courage to tell Vespasian, leave Yerushalayim alone. Instead, I asked him to leave a yeshiva in Yavne intact. And for this, he said, my students, I may go to hell. And the hell reserved for a person like me is grander than the hell reserved for anybody else, because people make individual choices, it's their own business. But people like myself, whose choices define a nation, make collective choices, and therefore their rewards and their punishments are on a different scale completely. In one word, he asked himself, am I not single-handedly responsible for the death of my people? He could not know. How could he? He lived that. We are living close to 2 millennia later. Hindsight is always 20/20. We sitting here today, a few days before Tisha B'Av, a few days before the 9th of Av, we can answer his question. He said, I don't know which path I'm going to go down. But we can look back and we can speak with conviction about which path he went down. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's request was not a simple request for spare me a building
Don't destroy the building in Yavne. Don't destroy the yeshiva. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's vision was perhaps far deeper than Vespasian's vision. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai understood one of the single most important truths about Jewish history, and yet one of the most misunderstood facts about Jewish history. And that is, Jewish history is never to be understood in the context of history of other nations. And it begins the moment we were created. What creates most nations? What creates most nations? What brings a nation together? Land. The founding fathers of the United States of America came to a new country, which later would become the United States of America. They were bound together by a piece of earth. That's what bound them together. Just like the Australians in Australia, and the French in France, and the English in England, and the Russians in Russia. That's the foundation of a nation. We're living together on one piece of earth. We've got to make it work. We got to unite. We got to defend ourselves from our enemies. We have to have a constitution. We have to have a system. We have to have a structure. How did they create an army? They create an infrastructure, a political one, a military one, an economic one, a social one. And of course, there are diverse political systems based on different ideologies and philosophies, dictatorships, monarchies, and democracies, etc., etc. Every nation begins with a land. It's the land that bounds the nation, and it's because of the land that the nation is connected. And therefore, when the nation is exiled from the land, when the nation is not on the land any longer, they don't have the common bounds. How about the Jewish people? When did the Jewish people become a nation? Were they in their land when they became a nation? Where were they? In a desert. So what turned them into a unit? What made them a nation? They weren't living. I'm an American, you're an American. That's our common denominator. We were born in the United States, or we immigrated, we became citizens. What was their common denominator? They weren't in a land, they were in a desert. What brought them together? A book. A book. A vision. An idea. Which we call the Torah. That's what defined them. In the nucleus. The nucleus of their civilization, the genesis of their being, what defined them as a nation was not a land. Later they went into a land. It was a book. It was a perspective. It was a vision. It was a commitment to a certain paradigm of what civilization is, of what humanity is, of what its destiny, and a lifestyle based on that. In one word, the Torah and its mitzvahs. The Torah and its commandments. So when Rabbi Saadia Gaon, one of the greatest Jewish philosophers in Babylonia, was asked in the 900s to define the Jewish people, what's the definition of the Jewish people? What defines the people? What's the common denominator of the people? He said, Umatenu einenu uma ki in the Torah Tera. The single definition of the structure of the Jewish people is its Torah. Now they were being exiled from the land. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is standing in front of the Vespasian. Here the representative of a small people about to be destroyed, in front of the superpower, the leader of the superpower of the world, Vespasian. Vespasian asked me for one thing. He tells Vespasian, in Yavne, there are yeshivas. They're studying Torah there. They're teaching Torah there. They're applying Torah there. I just need you to spare me, Yavne. Vespasian must have been thinking to himself, an old man, wise, but old, clever, but naive, interesting, but ultimately outdated. I'll spare him Yavne. I'll spare him Yavne. He didn't realize that by sparing Yavne that moment, he underwrote the death certificate for Rome
and the life certificate for the Jewish people. Because now, four with the tape recorder of history, 1,940 years, and ask one question. Where's Jerusalem? Where's Rome? Where's Julius Caesar? Where are the gladiators? Where are the Colosseums? Go to Caesarea. Go to Caesarea. Go to Caesarea, named after the word Caesar, which means Caesar. Caesar in Hebrew is Caesar. That's Caesarea. They were called the Caesars. And a Caesarian is also named by Caesar. You know that. Caesarean operation, right? For children who are not born naturally, sections. Why is it called Caesarean, you know? Huh? You know why it's called Caesarean? Yeah, so Tosfos writes, Tosfos is one of the Talmudic commentators in Tractate Avodah Zarah, that's the tractate that deals with idolatry. Tosfos writes that the first Caesar was born through a Caesarean surgery, not through the natural exit of a child. They had to cut open what's called Yotzei Dofen, they had to cut open the wall to take out the baby. So he was called Caesar. Caesarea. Where is Rome? Where is Julius Caesar? Where is Nero? Where is Vespasian? Where is Titus? Where is Hadrian? Where is Caligula? Where is the Roman Senate? Where is Roman glory? Where is Roman majesty? Where is Roman dominance? Where? In Wikipedia. That's where it is. And you can go to Caesarea, pay 18 shekel, right? And sit on the stadium, like we did a few days ago, and have a tour guide to tell you that 2 millennia ago, people killed each other right here. And this was the heights of Roman culture. You can go to Rome, and for $9.50, see the remnants of the Colosseum, and of the gladiators, and of the great gymnasiums and circuses. And you can read about it in history books. Where are the descendants and the children of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, of that lone Jewish rabbi who stood in front of Vespasian? Where are the Jewish people? Here. Right here in Jerusalem. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's name is mentioned every day among thousands of students who learn his teachings in the Talmud. I always find it fascinating. If you ever visit Rome, in Rome there is a place called the Arch of Titus. The Arch of Titus is an extraordinary place. Titus destroyed the temple. He came back to Rome with Jewish slaves. How do you celebrate victory? What they used to do is, they used to build an arch for you. They would cut out an opening in a wall, and you would march through that opening, and that's how you celebrated your victory. So when Titus came back to Rome, they built the Arch of Titus. You can go there today, and you'll see that they engraved on the Arch of Titus a picture of Jews in shackles, being led by Roman legions as slaves, carrying the vessels of the temple from Israel back to Rome. The menorah, the candelabra, and other vessels being carried from the defeated capital of the Jews, Jerusalem, to the great empire of Rome, in Italy. So the menorah is being carried to Rome. If you were standing right here then, 70, 71, when Titus came back, Jews chained, slaves, less than $1 a slave. And you would have to ask yourself, where should I cast my lot? In which culture will I find success? Where does the future lie? There would be no question. The future lies with Rome. This is it. Rome is on top of the world. The Jews had their glory, but they're gone, finished, obsolete, deleted. Like so many other cultures and civilizations. But now, you put the tape recorder of history, 1940 years. Titus, you can find in a history book. What about the menorah? A few months ago, on Hanukkah, 8 million homes, you had the menorah burning to commemorate the menorah in the temple.
burning by live people, live fathers and mothers and children. How did that happen? How did history make this twist? What happened? Doesn't make what happened? Rome lived another few hundred years, owned the world, but then in the 500s, it declined, it was gone, there's no Rome any longer. No Roman. I never went into Macy's or Century 21 or Starbucks and asked somebody, Shalom, who are you? And he said, ah, my Zayda was Julius Caesar. My Bubba was Cleopatra. Right? But the Jews, the same Nudniks who were here 3,000 years ago, same Nudniks are still there eating the filter fish and herring and kishka. Same Jews. And you could say, yeah, my Zayda was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, or a student or a friend or a Talmud. My Bubba was Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, Leah. How did that happen? It happened because of one reason. Because Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had vision. And he told Vespasian, I need Yavna and its sages. He understood one thing. If Torah will remain alive by the Jewish people, the people will live. The moment Torah will die by the Jewish people, they won't live. He understood this. A country is very important. A land is critical. We thank God every day that we have the land of Israel. We live here. We have an army to protect it. The Holy Temple in Jerusalem was the spiritual center of the world. But Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai understood that after everything said and done, even if they don't bring lambs every morning into the temple, as long as the Jewish people don't stop learning about it, they'll be able to live. They can live without the physical lambs being sacrificed in the temple. But if they delete from their consciousness, Mesechta Zvachim and Nachas Chulin, the Talmudic tractates that discuss these laws, then they won't have a future. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai understood that the unit, the glue, and the power of the Jewish people was not, what was it? What was it that really held it together? What was it that gave it its survival power? What was the secret of its endurance? What was it? A land? They were born before they had a land. They would now be exiled without a land. Is it a language? They were speaking Aramaic. Is it a culture? Many Jews would have different cultures over the ages. Is it an army? Well, most of the time, unfortunately, they didn't have an army. What was its secret? What was its power? A nation has to have a power, a message. What was it that sustained it? What would keep it together? What would allow it to live throughout thousands of years of exiles scattered around the world under different nations, persecuted, hunted down, good times and bad times, inspiring times and horrific times? What would keep and define this nation? He knew the way it was created is the way it will survive. It was created with an idea, with a book. So he told them, give me Yavna and its sages. Vespasian said, yes. That's the moment, unwillingly, he gave Jews their certificate for eternal life. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai got what he wanted. Despite the trauma, despite the pain, despite the tears, he knew Yavna will substitute the physical wall that Rome destroyed. The physical wall will now be substituted with a spiritual wall. And this spiritual wall will surround the Jewish people as a fortress and will never be breached. Heinrich Heine was a German Jew who converted to Christianity. He was a poet. Great poet, great German poet. A Jew, a Meshumet, he converted, baptized. He was once sitting with Germans in the 1700s. Before, many years before 1948, obviously. And they were scoffing at the Jewish people. They said, your people don't even have a homeland. What type of people are you? What type of people are you? You don't even have a homeland. You're parasites. You just live in other countries and you suck the milk and honey that flows in other countries. You don't even... Who heard of a nation without a homeland? What makes you a people? What makes you a nation?
Don't call yourself a nation. Call yourself a religion. What makes you a people? No homeland? Good question. What did make us a people outside of a homeland? That we once had a homeland? Heinrich Heine said, you're making a mistake. My people have a homeland. But their homeland is a portable one. And it's called the Torah. Heine understood the great truth about the Jewish people. As long as they had the Torah, they had a homeland. It was an invisible wall called Yavna that they took with them. And wherever the Jew was, he or she would come home at night from hard day at work. And they would open up a book of Torah. They would open up a book of Talmud, a book of Chumash, a book of Mishnayos, whatever it was. They learned, they studied, they observed the Torah, and they were in their homeland. They may have been in Spain or in Portugal. They may have been in Morocco or in Tunisia or in Algeria. They may have been in Brazil or in Moscow, in Odessa or in Galicia, in Sosnovitz or in Siget, in Leeds or in Sydney. They were in a homeland. They were in their homeland called the Torah. He said, you do have a home. We do have a homeland. But there was a Jew who lived in Israel. Very, very intelligent person. His name was Jacob Herzog. Name rings a bell with anybody. Huh? Jacob Herzog. Jacob Herzog. His brother, Chaim Herzog, was a president of Israel. After Shazar, Herzog was the president. Chaim Herzog. Their father was the chief rabbi of Israel. His name was Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog. Chief rabbi of Israel. After Rav Kook was Rav Herzog, Rabbi Herzog. One son became the president of Israel. Another one was Jacob Herzog, who was a great scholar. Wrote many books, died at a very young age, and he served as an ambassador of Israel to Canada. One man. Another man was a man named Arnold Toynbee. Anybody knows about Arnold Toynbee? Arnold Toynbee, was a historian. A very, Yes, a historian who didn't like the Jewish people that much. He says he was an anti-Semitic historian. And one of his great claims was that Jews have no claim to Israel. Why? Because Jews are a culture, not a civilization. A religion, not a people. Like Christians, Muslims. They live in different countries. There's no national homeland. It's not a nation. It's a religion. It's an idea. Judaism is an idea. It's not a nation. It's not a people. So this is not your homeland. And Toynbee would preach this. And once, there was a public debate, I believe in McGill University, between Professor Toynbee and Dr. Herzog on this question. I think it was broadcast on the radio too, those days, I think late 1950s. And Toynbee presented his claim that the Jews are not really a nation. Most of their history, they never had a homeland. They're not a people. We may share a religion, we're not a people, because we have no right to this land, Palestinians, Arab lands. There's no right to make a Jewish state here. Jacob Herzog responded, and I'm going to share with you the nucleus of what he said. Not verbatim, but the idea of what he said. Bear with me. Jacob Herzog said, my dear professor Toynbee, in your mind, let's have three Olympic planes landing in three different places. First Olympic plane lands in Athens. The door opens up. Out comes an old man. The man working in the airport goes up the stairs of the airplane, greets him. Hello! What is your name? He asks the old man who just landed. He said, my name is Socrates.
Socrates, I have a cousin by the name of Socrates. You're probably related to him.
Socrates turns to him and says, what's this language you're talking? What happened with ancient Greek? He said, oh, you professors still study it, but we don't speak that language anymore. And Socrates disapproves, gives a disapproval gesture with his hand.
The man says, hey, Socrates, what brings you here to Athens? Have you ever been here before?
He says, have I been here? You know who Socrates was? Greatest giant of Greek philosophy. Plato was a student. Aristotle was his student. He says, I never heard of you, I'm sorry.
He says, tell me, how is the Acropolis doing? How are the great Greek philosophers doing? Are we still giving the world philosophy and wisdom?
He says, my dear Socrates, times have changed. Greek philosophy is still studied by a few bookworms and by a few philosophers and by a few people who are still interested in reading Plato's Republic and the original. But it's not really, you know, a hot item today. Apple is doing much better than Greek philosophy. He says, tell me, how is the Greek Empire doing?
He says, the Greek Empire, you know what's happening in Greece? It's in the slums economically. What Greek Empire? If we could just survive as a country, we'll be happy. We're not an empire any longer.
He says, you mean Greek doesn't dominate the world? He says, no, Greek does not dominate the world.
Greece doesn't dominate the world? No, Greece doesn't dominate the world.
So what are you?
He says, we're a member in NATO. He says, what is NATO, for heaven's sake? He says, well, NATO is an organization that was founded in the 1940s. Start explaining it with NATO.
He tells me, tell me, can you take me to Zeus? I want to see the temple of Zeus. He says, what are you talking about? What Zeus? There's no Zeus here any longer. So he says, so what is, yeah? He says, we have the Greek Orthodox Church. He says, what in the world is the Greek Orthodox Church?
He says, well, it has to do with the Christians.
He says, what's that?
It's a Socrates. The Christian says there was a Jew, had a Jewish mother, always used to tell him he was God. He never got married. He never got married, so he never had a Jewish wife to tell him the truth. And therefore he continued to believe that he was God. And many people accepted it.
And there's the Greek Orthodox truth with about 100 Christian denominations. Socrates says, this is not a place for me. Bye-bye, Greece. Another plane lands in Rome. An Olympic plane. Out comes a man. Distinguished looking, prominent. You can see he's been through life. You can still see the 32. You could still see the impressions of 32 stabs in his heart. The flight attendant, the person working in the airport, goes up to greet him. Hello. Hello. How are you? What's your name? My name is Julius Caesar. Welcome, Julius. It's a very nice name. What brings you to Rome? Have you ever been here before? Julius Caesar, you haven't been here before. This is my country. Rome. How is Rome doing? Rome is doing fine. I just had pasta. Very, very good. A little pizza. Says, what's that? Says, these are the foods we like. Says, no, tell me. How is the Roman Empire? How is the Roman Empire still dominating the world? Are all the roads still leading to Rome? He says, Rome is not an empire. We're a city in Italy. He says, can you take me to the Temple of Venus? No Temple of Venus. What do you have? You have a Vatican. What's the Vatican? Start telling off Catholicism. Catholics again. Christians, Jews, gods, mothers. Trinities, Holy Spirits. The first one made a mistake. It said celebrate. They thought it said celibate, so they don't get married.
Ha, ha, ha.
says, which language are you talking? What happened to Latin? A couple of nerds still speak Latin, some great scholars. We speak Italian. He says, can you take me to the Colosseum? It's in ruins. Can you take me to the gladiators? In ruins. Can you take me to the great theaters? Roman theaters. It's in ruins. So he says, so what are we? He said, we're a city in Italy. We're a member of NATO. He says, what about the culture of Rome that we built? We don't have culture, but if you want, I can get you a slice of pizza. Julius Caesar says, have a good day, this is not for me. A third plane lands in Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv. He says, 55 minutes from here, without traffic. An old man comes. The flight, the man working in the airport comes up. Looks at this old Jew in the Olympic plane at the door. The man looks at him and says, Shalom Aleichem. And the old man responds and says, Aleichem Shalom. Mashimcha, he asks the old man, what is your name? And the man says, Shmi Moshe. My name is Moses. And the man working in the airport says, Eze Yafi Gamani Moshe! The Mashamal Aleichem! Moshe! He turns to the man in the airport. Where are you from? Ani mi Tbilisi. Georgia Tbilisi. Ani aliti li Israel. 7 years ago I made Aliyah. He says, and where are you from? Ani Moshe from Egypt. Mi Mitzrayim. I was born in Egypt. He says, Moshe from Egypt. Have you ever been here before? He says, no, never. Did you build this country? I never was in this country. So he says, so what brings you here? It's my country. But you've never been here before. But I dreamt a lot about this. I did a lot of work for this, for the preparations of this country. Greets him, gives him a hug. He says, Moshe, you must be hungry coming from Egypt to Tel Aviv. Let me tell you, right here, there's a great falafel stand. Delicious lapa. There's a kasher, it's kosher. Moshe says, it's kosher. What does kosher mean? After a million days, a mazze kasher. You don't know what's kosher. You open up a Torah to the Jew and to eat kosher foods. Fish have one type of kashrus. Birds have one type of kashrus. Meat have their kashrus. Trees of their constructs. You guys keep kosher? Of course. Moshe says, let me ask you a question. You may not know what I mean. I forgot to bring my talis and tefillin from the desert. I didn't put on tefillin today. You have still maybe in Israel in a museum maybe? He gets insulted. Look at me, I just put on tefillin. What are you? Comes out. Moshe says, what's this on the door? He says, the mezuzah. Moshe says, what's a mezuzah? He says, in here this parchment from the Torah that Moses wrote with section on every Jewish home, every Jewish door. Moshe says, there's a place where I could pray. Of course, right here there's a nice yeshiva. There's even a school there. Moses comes into the classroom. The teacher turns to the kids and says, please open up your book. And starts reading, Vayedaber Hashem El Moshe Lamer. God spoke to Moses. And the man tells Moses, I see you were never here. But let me tell you, on this street you have 10 synagogues. Sfard, Ashkenaz, Yeshivish, Yemen, Chabad, Iraq. Magdishach, Mekadesh, Kester, Yimlech, every Nusach, every version in the world. Yaakov Herzog turns to Professor Arnold Toynbee and says, Professor Toynbee, Greece is a nation. They have a national homeland. Italy is a nation. Caesar comes back. Socrates comes back. Not the same language. Not the same culture. Not the same faith. Not the same tradition. Not the same values. Not the same political system. Not the same arguments. Not the same fighting. Not the same foods. But it's a nation. Moses comes back 3,500 years later. Same language. Same types of arguments. Same values. Same faith. Same tradition. Same texts. Same daily conduct. And this is not a nation. This is not their homeland. If this is not a nation, what is a nation? For the first time in his life, Toynbee was quiet for a few moments. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was crying. Maybe he's going to go to hell. But we, 2,000 years later, could turn to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and said, we know exactly when down. And that's why right before he died, he said, make place for Chizkiah, the king of Judea. Why did Chizkiah come there? Why Chizkiah? And the answer is because the Assyrian king Sancheirib exiled 10 tribes of Israel. Till today we don't know where they are. 150 years before the destruction of the first temple, Sancheirib from Assyria came, exiled 10 tribes. They all assimilated. There's no remnant of them. The majority of them. Two complete tribes remain, Judah and Benjamin, in the southern part. So he came to destroy them too. Chizkiah was the king. He built the tunnel that we went into. And he saved Jerusalem from Sancheirib. Rabbi Yochanan was weeping because he didn't know whether he saved the Jewish people or he destroyed the Jewish people through his request. Who came to escort him to the next world? Chizkiah, the man who saved Jerusalem militarily. This was a statement that you, Rabbi Yochanan, history will thank you for saving the Jewish people and ultimately allowing them to come back to their land. Ultimately allowing them to come back to that city which was destroyed. Because the spark of Yavne, the flame of Yavne, was never extinguished. And hence they can come back to the land. And rebuild themselves on every single level. Because the Torah was always a homeland from which they never left. Thank you very much.